Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, the chairman of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. We also welcome our listening audience, both on the radio and online, and we invite everyone to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. It's my pleasure to introduce our speaker today, Ken Corelli, a child psychologist, practices in Orinda, California, in East Bay, and is also the school psychologist at Bentley School. He's talking about a fascinating topic about, you know, post-World War II psychologists wanted to be as disciplined as any other science and became, you know, really went into trying to disciplinedly put about, you know, metrics for their system, and he has some very interesting observations about it. I only have one thing to say about it tonight before the thing starts, and that is the 20th century was very successful at measuring things. A lot of times when we talk about problems, and we often talk about problems at Monday Night Philosophy and how to solve them and so on, a lot of times problems are just, you know, you just do everything all wrong. But the most interesting problems are the things actually you do too well, that you're too good at something, and then you overstate its value. In this case, the 20th century overstates the value of measurement because we're so good at measuring things, improving things based on measurements, that sometimes they get used in ways which don't prove as productive as we were hoping. So, Kent Grelling.
Hello. I want to thank you guys all for coming out. And this initial slide I thought I would put up just for your amusement at the beginning. You'll see that later on it hopefully relates to the rest of the talk. There we go. So to start out, I wanted to introduce myself a little bit and talk a little about how I got an interest in this topic and where my background in this comes from. Now, as George said, I have a private practice in Orinda, California. I'm a child psychologist. But my interest in this topic dates back all the way to the time that I was in graduate school. And my wife, who is in graduate school with me, remembers an argument I got into with my peers about diagnosis. It became one of those arguments where you're sticking with it despite the fact that no one else seems to understand what you're talking about. And what I was trying to explain is that I felt that diagnoses, psychiatric diagnoses, don't have the same fundamental reality that we sometimes treat them as. We talk about depression or we talk about schizophrenia as diseases, partly because we've grown up with this idea of these constructs of mental disorders, but that they really are, to a large extent, culturally defined. And they can be defined even within our culture in very different ways than they have been. And a lot of our thoughts about this now have been influenced by the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association, which I assume people familiar with this? I assume there's a lot of mental health professionals here. So, I became interested in this very young, and then my specialty gradually evolved into really early childhood development. I used to run an early childhood clinic. We focused just on kids under five, and a lot of my work was with children with developmental disorders, particularly autism, but other, you know, or mental retardation and other kinds of early developmental disorders. And as I started doing that work, it became increasingly clear to me that diagnosis had some very, very profound implications. With younger kids that sometimes with adults I didn't worry. You know, whether I called something depression or an adjustment disorder with depressed mood or dysthymia, well, it didn't really make all that much difference. But when you diagnose somebody with autism, it has very profound implications for the kinds of treatment they're able to receive, the treatment they will receive, what they're eligible for legally, the implications for their parents in terms of prognosis, what they think the outcome is going to be. And I really wanted to find a way to be better at making these diagnoses or to find out what were really the key factors that determine prognosis for a kid. And the more I looked at it, the more I realized there wasn't a there. A lot of the diagnoses, particularly the autism spectrum disorder diagnoses, are not particularly research-based. These've been kind of created by committees ad hoc, and it isn't all that clear that the different diagnoses necessarily correspond to different outcomes for children. So around the same time that I became interested in that, my son, who is now 11 years old, was also getting very interested in maps for some reason, and he's still very interested in maps. And I began to think a lot about maps because he would ask questions about them. He would ask, you know, why why certain maps had some features that another map of the same territory didn't have. How do we decide what goes in the map and what doesn't go in the map? And to some extent, there's simple answers to that, like its size, right? A big lake goes on the map, but a small lake doesn't. But as you start looking into it, you realize it's not just size. It's also importance, right? So a small road that's the only road that connects two communities may be put on a map when an equally sized road that's more of a bypass, more of a detour, won't be put on the map, right? That maps exist, that things are put on maps because of their importance. That's their importance to the user of the map. And I began to realize that a lot of our diagnostic system we can think of kind of the same way. It's a map to sort of the territory of human experience or maybe just human pain, emotional pain. And when we look at it, it's not necessarily a very accurate way, or it's not the only way of reflecting that experience. In the same way that you use a different map for taking a hike in an area than you would for driving by car, there are multiple ways to look at it, and it doesn't mean that one is necessarily better than the other. Okay? So that's where the mismapping the mind idea comes from. And I'm going to back up a lot now and hopefully go over some stuff that's pretty basic for much of you. So the first thing, the DSM-1, this book, I assume, like I said, most of you are familiar with it. The DSM-1 was released in 1952. It was met with a resounding thud in the market of mental health professionals. You can tell how many copies of it were sold by the fact that you cannot buy one. I've tried for a long time to find one. I found one, a damaged copy, for $800. Was the closest I could get. It has a limited number of disorders. There's only 106 disorders. It's only 130 pages long, so it's sort of a glorified pamphlet. And it is based much more on the idea of underlying causes of mental illness. So it takes a pretty psychodynamic, psychoanalytic approach, and it talks about the underlying cause. And in that paradigm, symptoms, what's expressed, are considered, you know, sort of passing interest, but not really diagnostic, right? It's the underlying conflicts, the unconscious conflicts that drive things. So that book didn't get a lot of play. The DSM-2, a little bigger, it's 134 pages, so it's about 4 pages longer. It added a lot of disorders. It's about 184 disorders. Very much runs the same approach as the DSM-1 did, okay? But the first DSM that really changed things and became widely popular was the DSM-3, and that was my first DSM. And the DSM-3 took a dramatically different take than the previous versions had done. And what it did is it emphasized categories of different illness. It really talked about mental disorder versus health, and these things were distinct entities. It takes the medical model to an extreme. And it also has, people called it at the time, a descriptive approach. Other people call that a symptomological approach, which is it looks only at observable symptoms. And this was done for a wide variety of reasons. Partly, this was the triumph of people who were researchers in mental health over people who were clinicians in mental health, because the researchers felt, I needed something operational that I can define as depression, and if I can't measure it and look at it and get it very concrete, I'm never going to be able to get a consistent sample, right? But also insurance companies wanted something that was more clear-cut, that you could get good inter-rater reliability on whether somebody had depression or dysthymia or what have you, okay? You can tell the difference between this and the earlier editions because you can pick up a copy of this used all over the place, you know. The DSM went through several revisions. You got the DSM-3R, which is about 500-something pages long. Our current version, which is the DSM-4, it's now 886. Actually, this is not the current version. It's 886 pages long. And then the DSM-4-TR, text revision, which keeps all the same diagnoses but adds some additional background information, and it's almost 1,000 pages long. So the next thing we have is the DSM-5, and the DSM-5 is in progress right now. It's in field trials. In fact, the diagnostic categories have sort of been defined. They're testing them and refining them in a variety of sites across the country. It's supposed to be released in May of 2013, and will likely, I think, hit that target. And it's a huge endeavor. It's literally thousands of writers involved in this, committees on every subclass of disorders you can imagine, public comment, a whole website at dsm5.org if you're interested in it, where you can find out about current revisions, what's planned, things they've thought about and discarded, et cetera. So it's an enormous endeavor, and like I said, likely to come out very, very soon. So summarizing again, we have this approach for mental disorders now, which is a symptomological approach. So we're talking about these overt symptoms. We talk about diagnostic syndromes. These are these clusters of specific sets of symptoms. And there isn't a single symptom that's diagnostic. There's no defining characteristic of any individual disorder. And for those of you who are not familiar, I thought I would quickly put this up. So this is what we're looking at for autistic disorder. And I'm not going to go through all this, but so you get a, for those of you who don't know this, a sense of the quality of this is, you know, it's sort of a menu, and you pick two from this and one from that and three from that, and if you have that, then you have the disorder, okay? So, you know, you get six or more items from section one, that's here. I couldn't fit it on one slide. Section two, these are impairments in communication. You need one of those. Section three at the top there, you need one of those too. Then a number of kind of criterias to rule out other disorders. So it has to have occurred by a certain age and then has to have affected them in a certain number of areas. And then you get the diagnosis. Okay, so theoretically, this should be something that's pretty straightforward and relatively people can come to good iterator reliability on a diagnosis like this. However, as I started to say about the DSM-1, there's a very different approach, which is a sort of etiological approach to classification, which is where you base diagnosis on the underlying cause of the disorder. So it's hard to talk about this with psychiatry, as I'll get to in a second, but when you're talking about physical health, you have something like stroke. Stroke can have a wide variety of different symptoms. Presentation between one patient and another can be hugely different. But we know that there's something underlying that goes on. So, and there's, you know, basically two kinds of stroke, the ischemic and hemorrhagic stroke. Ischemic is where you have a blockage, and a hemorrhagic stroke is where you have a bleed in the brain. They can, in fact, look very similar. The symptom pattern that's presented can look nearly identical. So you base the diagnosis on this underlying cause. You have to do an MRI or some other test that discovers the underlying cause, and that's how you make the diagnosis, and the symptom pattern is not so important. Now, stroke's a really good example on the sort of far end of this, but there's a whole range of stuff in between. Alzheimer's is one that I bring up. Alzheimer's, you know, when you make the diagnosis, it talks about certain areas that are impacted. You can recognize that you have some of those areas impacted in a client. But again, the diagnosis of it's called definite Alzheimer's is based on histopathology. There has to be these amyloid plaques in the nerve cells, right? Some of you who work with older people are probably more familiar with this than I am. So you can't make the diagnosis fully until you see that there's this underlying cause, right? Okay. So what you see for a lot of disorders is that there's a movement over time from symptoms to cause, right? So HIV is a pretty obvious example, or AIDS is a pretty obvious example of this. People began to see AIDS. They saw a certain pattern of symptoms in people. They learned to recognize those symptoms. Over time, that helped define that subgroup of people, and research was then done that found the underlying cause, HIV, right? When you find that underlying cause, then that becomes the defining characteristic of the disorder, and it changes the whole notion of the disorder, because before that, we weren't really aware that, for example, there are people who can remain HIV positive for years without developing AIDS. The whole sense of what the disorder is and sort of its parameters and who qualifies or qualifies, who can be diagnosed legitimately with that and who can't, isn't clear until you know that underlying cause. And I hope that's making sense, right? That it causes this paradigm shift, okay? Now, it would be great if we had that for psychiatry, but we don't. The problem is we know almost nothing about cause. And part of the problem that we're having right now is that our very approach to diagnosis, I think, is limiting our ability to find the underlying causes, and I will get back to that. There are a few things in psychiatry. The one that occurs to me from childhood disorders is something called Rett syndrome, which is a genetic disorder. It was obviously a genetic disorder for a long time. They know the specific gene now that causes it, and so we have a diagnosis. The odd thing is in the DSM-5, they're going to remove Rett's from the diagnostic, from the autism spectrum disorders, because it's felt now that it's just separate. It's another thing. It's not an autism spectrum disorder. Okay. So given that we're stuck with this sort of symptomological approach, I want to talk about what some of the limitations of that approach are and where we run into problems with it. One of the big problems is the problem of comorbidity, which is our disorders don't neatly define individual people, okay? In terms of individual people, over the lifespan, most people qualify for the criteria for more than one diagnosis. So, for example, general anxiety and depression is a really obvious one, that the majority of people who have depression have some degree of anxiety, and the majority of people who are diagnosed with anxiety have some degree of depression. They're kind of, inextricable. In fact, twin studies done on major depression show that the identical twin of a person with major depression is as likely to suffer with generalized anxiety disorder as they are to suffer with major depression. So that even suggests that there's an underlying genetic underpinning that's the same for them. And in fact, the idea that they are different disorders is something that's relatively culturally specific. This is not my area of expertise, but I have a colleague who does kind of cross-cultural psychology in Russia, and Russians see anxiety and depression and somatic symptoms as a syndrome all their own. That's that they see them as interconnected, and for them, that's a unitary kind of disorder or pattern of symptoms. So the question then becomes like, well, we've divided this up this way. Is that an accurate reflection of what's really going on? Okay. So just bringing up an example in children with autism, you see some of these things, 60% with poor attention and concentration. I'll get back to that in a minute, but so you've got the majority of kids with autism who have an attention disorder. The fact is you can't diagnose children with autism with ADHD. Why? Because in the DSM it says you can't. It just says if you have ADHD, you don't have autism, and if you have autism, you don't get diagnosed with ADHD. So there's these sort of arbitrary rules that exist in some places that rule out different diagnoses. And when you look at this, you see a lot of other things like depressed mood is very common, particularly when you look at kids with higher functioning autism spectrum disorders, Asperger's. Virtually every kid I've ever met with Asperger's has some level of sort of anxiety and obsessive compulsive thinking, okay? You could do a similar slide, I'm sure, for major depression or schizophrenia or whatever. These things go on all the diagnoses, right? One of the problems, talking about autism spectrum, is the issue that there seem to be these sort of diagnostic spectrums, that we divide things into categorical diagnoses when it's not really clear that there are categorical diagnoses. We try a little bit with something like dysthymia versus depression to say, okay, this is a spectrum. You have an adjustment disorder and then dysthymia and then depression. But a lot of other things, it's not that clear cut, like when you think about anxiety disorders. They're just sort of different from each other. You have all these related, panic and OCD and generalized anxiety disorder, but they don't really represent a spectrum. And the problem with this is that you lose a lot of data about people. When you collapse all this and say, okay, it's just generalized anxiety disorder, you lose all the interesting pieces in there about, how people differ from each other. One of the other things that happens a lot of times is the actual symptoms themselves, like I'm saying here, are on a spectrum. So you have some kids who have motor tics, right? They have an eye blink or a twitch. And then we talk about motor mannerisms, which are going like this. And then you have obsessive-compulsive things, which is if you do this, but you do it with a certain kind of thought, now this is a compulsion, right? And the reality is a lot of those kids are the same kids. There's lots of kids who have tic disorders, who have somewhat autistic behaviors, who go on to develop OCD, particularly as they get older. There's a huge overlap between Tourette's syndrome and OCD and the other tic disorders in OCD. Okay? We also find, like, with genetic things, that there are single genes that seem to underlie a range of different developmental or psychiatric disorders. So one of the genes that's been getting a lot of study right now is the Reglan2 gene, which seems to be implicated in bipolar and autism and schizophrenia. So if you've got one gene that seems to be implicated in all these different things, are these really three different things? I ask at the bottom here, you know, a lot of spectrum disorders is the thing du jour, it seems. Autism spectrum disorders, I think, started it, but now we hear a lot of people talking about obsessive compulsive spectrum disorders, anxiety spectrum disorders, depressive spectrum disorders. And actually, DSM-5 is going to include a little bit of kind of ratings on these spectrums. So example, autism spectrum disorders, you have these five diagnoses that are included in the autism spectrum. The problem with this is it's not clear at all what the spectrum is. I mean, a spectrum suggests that there's a low end and a high end, and it's on a linear dimension, right? It's easy enough to say autism anchors the low end of this, the far end of the spectrum, but everything else in there, it's not clear at all where that goes.
Hoarding
behavior. You know, another thing that's related to OCD. You know, it seems very similar to obsessive-compulsive behaviors, but most people who hoard can't get an obsessive-compulsive disorder diagnosis because they don't technically meet the criteria for OCD. Okay. This is the biggest problem in my mind, which is the problem of the heterogeneity of these diagnoses. Again, going back to autism, just because it's something I know well, you saw that there were four criteria in three different areas, right? You need two from the first one from the second one, and one from the third one. So in theory, two different people diagnosed with autism can share not a single common symptom. You can have two people who both meet the criteria, who don't have anything in common. In fact, you could actually have three people who only share one single symptom in common. Right? And everything else about them is different. Now, theoretically, I don't know that that happens in practice all that much. But the problem with that is that when a diagnosis is so diverse, when you have people you have one person in my practice who clearly qualifies for a diagnosis of autism, but is functioning relatively well in school, has a genius level IQ, and another person who's nonverbal, right? Those two people, what is the value in giving them the same label? Does it direct treatment? Does it help with research at all? And I think that's a really big issue, right? Is if those two people are clustered together in a single sample for research, it's not surprising that we can't find what causes the disorder because they may not have the same thing. Does that clear? Particularly with like genetic studies and early childhood studies, we're trying to look at these things. We're undermining our own ability to eke out these very subtle things that drive these diagnoses. And the reality is, if you ask me, I think there's probably 10 or 100 different kinds of autism that are all triggered by slightly different genetic mutations, early childhood, you know, birth trauma and stuff like that, that could all drive that. Okay. This is another issue which I think I touched on a little bit with subclinical syndromes, which is the hoarding one comes to this, which is OCD is a great example that OCD, it's really hard to get diagnosed with OCD technically. A lot of people who every clinician who encounters them thinks of them as having OCD, don't really meet the criteria for OCD. The same is true for Tourette's, that a lot of kids that we think of that as like pretty clearly what's going on with them. They have verbal and motor tics, but if they don't have them at exactly the same time in the same place, they don't really meet the criteria for the diagnosis, whereas other diagnoses are very easy to meet. Autism being one of them that, you know, part of what they've done with autism research, people are familiar with Asperger's. Asperger's is supposed to be high-functioning autism. But the reality is when you really apply strict clinical criteria, it is the tiniest, tiniest fragment of kids and adults who really meet the criteria for Asperger's. Really, almost everybody who gets that label really meets the criteria for autistic. And if they meet the criteria for autistic, they're not Asperger's. It supersedes Asperger's. So, you know, what they're doing in the next DSM is they're going to probably get rid of all the subcategories of autism and just call it all autism. So the problem with this is that when you don't recognize these sort of subclinical syndromes, it makes it very difficult for people to get reimbursed. It makes it difficult to drive treatment. And again, you have the same problem with research, which is, okay, now this time there may be a much larger population of people who meet the criteria for this disorder, but we're not getting all of them because we have these our overly strict definition, and so we can't figure out, there's not enough sample size to figure out what's driving these disorders. Okay, and this last one I talked about, which is the problem of arbitrary exclusions, which is, this is largely just a, it's just a political artifact of the fact that these things are made by committees and they're not always well coordinated with each other. And so sometimes they say one committee decides, oh, you can't make this diagnosis with that diagnosis. It should be a rule out for this diagnosis, whereas other people on another committee might not agree with that. So why does this all matter? I think I've covered the majority of this. You know, you can't really diagnose these things by cause anyhow, and we need diagnosis for a range of good reasons. You know, I can be dismissive about insurance or access to programs, but these are very important things, and you need to gatekeep sometimes. You know, there's limited resources. But I think the problem that we have right now is we have confused the map of diagnosis with the landscape that it's supposed to represent. You know, as they did in that little Borges clip, We believe that major depression is a disease in and of itself, and pharmaceutical companies are, you know, a big help in our believing that. But then when you believe that, you stop seeing the way it's interconnected to everything else. So my example about this that I came up with several years ago in trying to explain this is, imagine if you took a similar symptomological approach to physical health disorder and you said, well, we're going to look at the fever spectrum. We're just going to look at fevers. And we're going to divide every kid who comes into the ER into high, medium, and low fever groups. Okay? We can do that with great reliability, great validity, right? We'll get the same result every time, and we can get two different measures of fever to agree with each other. You know, you can take an oral and an ear temperature. They're totally consistent. You know, we've got these great measures. You can talk about you know, all the validity of these things, and you can even show that there's a syndrome, right, that high fever kids are lethargic, vomit, hallucinate, et cetera, right, that there's a whole pattern, a cluster of symptoms around this. But then the problem is, what do you do if you try to discover the cause of fever? And you group all the high fever kids together, and you try to look, what is it that they share in common? Well, they don't really share anything in common. What's the outcome? What's the correct treatment for fever? Well, it depends, you know. Maybe it's aspirin, maybe it's an antibiotic, maybe it's an antifungal, you know, maybe it's something else, okay? If you don't slice the pie right at the beginning, you can't figure out what's driving all these disorders. Go on to the next slide here. So, you know, I give the example of the different ways of measuring fever and that they have great reliability. This is the same thing we do in psychiatry all the time, which is we use our diagnostic system and a bunch of experts diagnose people, and then we develop a pencil and paper measure. And that pencil and paper measure, if it agrees with the experts, with their classifications, then it's valid. But nobody's questioning the underlying diagnosis in the first place, right? We're not questioning whether this is a group of symptoms that really hangs together in the population or where its boundaries are, because the syndromes themselves are basically defined by committee. And the more people look into them, the more it seems to undermine the diagnoses. We debate diagnoses with each other. This is particularly a big issue, I think, with early childhood stuff where, you know, psychiatrists and psychologists and neurologists, we all say, oh, well, you know, he doesn't diagnose this or he does diagnose that or he's too lenient in making a diagnosis. And we get into these battles about whether this child has autism or pervasive developmental disorder, when the reality is we don't know that there's any fundamental difference between the two things, that it's somewhat an arbitrary distinction to begin with. And the big one that I see is when I used to do a lot of testing, patients would be sent for evaluations to try to make diagnostic determinations between things that really didn't make all that much difference. You know, a kid who's PDD and a kid who has autism, you're trying to determine what they need. You need to look at what they're specifically doing, not at the diagnosis. It doesn't drive that, right? Can the kid read or not read? You know, are they toilet trained or not toilet trained? Who cares whether they have PDD or autism? One of the things that I would say that I think is important about this is I don't want to make it sound like we're terrible at making diagnoses. We're really pretty good. We can see we have great agreement on prototypical cases. So we can look at somebody who's dead center in the middle of depression, and we can say we can all agree that that person has depression, or who's dead center in the middle of autism, and it's easy. But the problem is there's this blurry area around that where we really have a lot of problems. And our diagnostic system doesn't even allow us to sort of recognize that we have problems. That's the difficulty. That's important information that this person is not prototypical, right? That should be acknowledged because it does drive treatment to some extent. But if you have no way of acknowledging that in how you give a diagnosis, you're stuck with it. This is the ADHD, giving programs for ADHD or autism. This happens all the time in the school district, that the qualifying disability that a kid has puts them in a program, and sometimes one that's completely inappropriate for the child, right? Because, you know, it's based on the diagnosis. Oh, he's autistic, so this is the program we have for kids with autism. I see this less now in the school system because I think people in the school districts are much more sophisticated than they used to be. I see it a lot with adult services for people with developmental disabilities. I had a kid who's very bright, successful in high school, good student, you know, but doesn't have the ability to live independently and go to college, and they had him working in a menial job with a bunch of people who were mentally retarded. And, you know, it's just he was very frustrated by it. Okay. I think I've covered most of this. It's not that these categories, I want to stress, too, that it's not that they're completely arbitrary. I don't mean that, like, somebody just threw things up in the air and it fell down. But it's not really empirical, either. And there really is a way that you could make this empirical, which I don't want to get into, but maybe later would. And these boundaries, I think it's important for us to recognize that boundaries between mental health disorders don't really exist. You can say that somebody is in or out of a diagnostic category, but really that is not true, right? There is a blurry area. Every disorder really exists on some sort of spectrum. Okay, so there's a lot of concern about people, the direction DSM-5 will take. That's sort of an old slide because now the direction DSM-5 is taken is pretty well set. And there's increasing pressure for a firm scientific basis for diagnostic categorization. And I think when I said about autism being all just lumped into one category now, that's part of what happened is people just, in essence, they gave up. They realized they couldn't come up with a diagnostic criteria that really clearly, accurately sliced the pie, I like to say. The word you always hear in this literature is carve nature at the joints, which is, you know, make those divisions between one diagnosis and another at the logical place. There's a thing on the DSM website where somebody, one of the people on one of the committees said trying to subdivide autism is like trying to carve meatloaf at the joints. And I think that's really true because it's just kids differ so much with on neurological functions that it's very hard to make that happen. So, but the other issue that happens with the DSM-5 at this point is it has become so important culturally that there's little hope that you're going to come up with a scientific answer to this because there's people who have enormous stakes now in the decisions that are made about what diagnoses are in or out. You know, new diagnoses are being proposed, old diagnoses are being gotten rid of, and there are stakeholders in this who have, you know, drug companies have money at risk, parents and patients have their future, their ability to access treatment at risk, and so they have an influence on that process. And I'm not saying they shouldn't have an influence on the process because it clearly influences them. It just precludes it being done in a completely rational way. So that is it. This it's not coming out as clearly on that one, but I don't know why my formatting got messed up. But Emil Kraepelin was one of the first people who really started trying to subdivide mental health diagnoses. And even in 1917, he said, you know, it's not clear that there's a division between the mentally ill and the normal, but things exist on a spectrum. And that's it. I said 40 minutes, didn't I? This is 6:40 p.m.
Thanks a lot, Ken. That was just great. I'll start with a question. I don't remember what the diagnosis was, but I remember reading about 15 or 20 years ago that in the state of Arkansas, they decided to give $50 a month more to children who had some developmental disorder prior to kindergarten. And within 3 years, one-third of all the children entering kindergarten had been diagnosed with that disorder. There's that element as well, that the parents of some kids, you know, for the extra $50 a month, and I think you're talking about the political process and everything, and you went to it a lot of other elements, but that obviously has a big impact on how we deal with the whole issue as well.
Yeah, I meant to say that at the beginning, that there are a whole other ways and ranges of arguments to be made with psychiatric diagnosis that I'm not going to get into, because I think those arguments get made a lot, but that's clearly, and autism is a perfect example of that. When you're diagnosed with autism, that's an eligibility criteria in the school districts, but Asperger's is not. So getting a diagnosis of autism in early childhood makes you eligible for special education programs and a whole range of other things that Asperger's can make you eligible, but autism is there in the law. There's a similar mental health parity bill in California that gives people with autism and a range of other disorders, they have right to full mental health insurance parity. They can't, the same caps and copays and everything else as physical health. But, you know, that's there for autism, but it's not there for Asperger's. So.
The other element of the choice here, too, is you qualify for support, financial support, qualify under the law for different things, but what is the impact on the child who gets, you know, put into a certain category that really, really doesn't fit the child or an adult? I mean, that's another element of the whole issue.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, the wrong categorization can be, kids don't like to be labeled anyhow, and particularly a bad label can be very damaging for kids.
Okay. Questions?
Yes, I work in a school district, and autism like this, like it's so happening now. I mean, it's been around for a long time, but the cause is still fuzzy, and are we overdiagnosing in this category?
That's a great question. I don't know what the answer to that is, and as somebody who spent a lot of time trying to figure it out, I think it's a little bit of both. I think there's certainly in the last 10, 15 years heightened awareness of people with high-functioning autism, and that's led to a massive increase in diagnoses. And those people have pulled along a whole group of people that we don't talk about, which are the MR, the mentally retarded kids, who really are autistic, but they had an MR label and nobody was really worried about it, and now people are looking and going, oh, but this kid really has motor mannerisms and all these other things. It's really autism, and that pulls in a whole bunch. But the question of whether there's really an increase in the population is not clear. It's clear that we've increased the diagnosis. That's at least part of it. But whether that's the only thing, there's a number of people who have said they, you know, the epidemiological studies that have said it does look like there's a real increase in incidence. And it's, I have to tell you, every time they do epidemiological studies, the rate goes up. You know.
I believe that up until not too many years ago, homosexuality was considered a disease. And then I guess it was American Psychiatric Association said no more. I think there are considerable differences between the incidence of disease in males and females, particularly like autism hits heavily in the males, whereas genius is also many, many more males. Aren't there at one time some political implications that in the communist dialectic considered certain diseases the result of suppression, the chains, and so forth? I mean, are you aware that that existed at some point?
Mm-hmm.
It's just interesting.
Yeah, it's hard. And, you know, the issue is that there's all sorts of disorders. Neurological disorders, many of them are more common among men. Even the sort of non-psychiatric neurological disorders are more common among men. So it's hard to know. But ADHD, diagnosed like 10 times as often in boys as girls. Autism, about 10 times as often, you know. And even when autistic disorders get diagnosed in girls, a lot of times it looks very different. So,
hi. I was wondering what you thought of the Dream Team approach to planning a blitz on schizophrenia by Solomon Snyder and his group at Johns Hopkins.
It's not my area of expertise, so I don't know about
it. Well, they basically announced it in the July 9th edition of Science this year, and basically it's the Lieber family has given $100 million to form an institute, and they have decided to associate with Johns Hopkins, and Solomon Snyder is one of the directors of the institute. And they're planning a blitz not only on schizophrenia but on mental health problems, kind of combining what I gather in basic research in neurosciences and neurochemistry, genetics, and psychiatric backgrounds. And I think that approach, certainly they're trying that approach with Stand Up for Cancer,
mm-hmm.
and the Dream Team approach. But I think what they're planning is a very focused institute where mental health and mental health issues and basic research are their primary, and opening communications and trying to get breakthroughs to patients as mm-hmm. rapidly as possible is their number one criteria. And I was wondering if you had, you know, discussed this or if this has been of any interest.
Yeah, it's not. I am not aware of that. I know, you know, one of the things I felt about schizophrenia from my graduate training, though, is it suffers the same problem that a lot of developmental disorders do, which is it's just too broad of a category. There's so many dissimilar people who get lumped together in that category. And one of the things that I see is I've watched kids go from early childhood, you know, learning disabilities, developmental things, on and on and on to eventual psychosis and schizophrenia. And other kids had none of that, and they develop eventual psychosis. And those two groups of kids seem to me like there's got to be something fundamentally different. You know, I've seen a number of kids who are diagnosed on the autism spectrum now go on to develop psychosis. And, you know, again, I don't think the pie has been sliced correctly. And until we do that, I think that's got to be a big part of it, of how they, you know, figure this stuff out.
I was wondering if you could give us some hints as to how you think this might be done a little more empirically.
A quick hint on how it can be done. People familiar with the MMPI? It's a diagnostic tool. They throw 500 questions at somebody, and they use something called factor analysis or cluster analysis to just see how answers to those questions, they're all true, false, how they hung together. And they come up with a number of scales. Now, the MMPI isn't necessarily the best way of doing this. But what you find when they did it is that there were scales that came out of that that don't really correspond very well to any diagnosable mental health conditions. Psychasthenia is the most common one, which is a combination. The psychasthenia scale has some items about somatic, like physical complaints, feeling lethargic and run down and sick and whatever, some stuff about anxiety and some stuff about kind of chronic depressed mood in it. I think that's part of it, is you need to figure out a way to get to the very basic level of the symptoms and then use statistics to see how they fall together. But I think the other thing that would be really useful is allowing clinicians and researchers to diagnose, to note in diagnosis how prototypical a case is. And maybe one of the things that you do with that is, instead of saying there's these specific criteria, and if you have to have three of this and two of that and one of those, you say, this is a prototypical case of autism. You have, you know, delays in early language, you have motor mannerisms, you have whatever, X, Y, and Z. You go down this whole list and you say, that is the prototypical autistic case. And you decide whether your case has autism based on how close it fits that prototype, and you rate it. 1 to 5 scale. One is a perfect, you know, it's nearly identical to the prototype, and a 5 is, you know, very, very low similarity to the prototype. And, you know, for insurance companies and other things, you say, oh, well, you need better than a 3. It's still going to be very subjective, and there's going to be diagnosis creep because of that, but that all exists now. At least you would have some way of kind of recognizing that this person is or is not very prototypical in that situation. But I think, you know, I think research like that is being done by National Institute of Mental Health and stuff, trying to eke some of this stuff out and improve these diagnoses. It's just not going to happen for DSM-5. And it's too hard to change the way everybody's used to doing things.
The New York Times published an article a few years ago entitled "The Epidemic of Diagnoses." And so I'm interested, you know, in the point that you made that the DSM-5 is supposed to decrease diagnoses, and I've worked in the field for some 25 years too, both in school districts and at UCSM and so forth, and I see a lot of what I regard as overdiagnoses, and oftentimes because clinicians aren't getting naturalistic observations, they're just seeing the child in a clinic, and you know, it just isn't an adequate evaluation that's being done. So how do you see the DSM-5 is potentially decreasing diagnoses?
I don't think the DSM-5 is necessarily going to decrease the number of children who are diagnosed. It will decrease the number of categories of diagnosis, potentially. There's been a sort of, it's leveling off, right? The difference between DSM-3R and DSM-4 is small. I can't remember. It's like another 40 diagnoses or something like that. So there may be less categories. Diagnosis creep and the giving of diagnosis to kids, I don't think that's going to stop, because there's, you know, partly it's good. There's less stigma attached to mental health diagnosis than there was, you know, 20 years ago. And so people are more willing to come out and get it. There's also more adequate treatments, and especially for children, you know, there's services that can be provided to them that are, you know, valuable. But the issue of just giving too many kids the diagnosis, I don't think that's going to change, you know. Kids getting diagnoses because they want extended time on the SATs or whatever. That's
question.
Aside from diagnoses, what about the use of medication? Are we really getting way down to increasing medication a lot?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that I think that I'm not an anti-medication person. I think medication is great, but it's pretty clear that pharmaceutical companies have a huge incentive to expand diagnosis, right? The more they expand diagnosis, the more people are eligible to take their medications. And so, you know, there's all sorts of things that are moving into accepted diagnoses now that didn't exist before. And it's tough, I mean, because it goes both directions. There are tons of untreated people out there, kids who suffer, adults who suffer, who've never been diagnosed. I mean, I can't tell you how many adults I've seen in my practice who clearly should have been diagnosed with a developmental disorder. You know, you get their history and everything else and from their parents, and it's obvious, and they kind of were just left to hang, but it goes the other direction as well. So,
Is there also like a movement in the New Age area, like we're trying to do something more with massage or relaxation or music? And we're kind of moving that way, aren't we?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's more and more evidence about the difference that really basic diet. This is where I start with every client is diet, exercise, and sleep. I mean, it's the foundation to mental health. And I would add on that meditation, relaxation, I think, has been found over and over again to have positive influences on just about every mental health condition. So,
right now, we're in the worst unemployment statistics since the late 30s. And I think in the past, people have held jobs that they've been able to sublimate whatever mental problems they might have. But I think if someone is out of work an extended period of time, some of these that have been under the surface will come to the attention and require some form of medical intervention or some attention.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I haven't, to be honest, I haven't given that a lot of thought. But I think that that's right, right? Pressure, increased stress. You know, certainly you would expect that there would be more, certainly instances of depression and things like that, but also other mental health issues.
In some situations, don't you think the treatment is worse than the disease? In other words, in schizophrenia, some of the medications that they are prescribing for schizophrenics are like risperidone in some of those medications. The toxicity and side effects of some of those medications are what I consider unacceptable and atrocious. So I always highly recommend people get three independent opinions to prevent misdiagnosis.
Yeah,
because
and
those medications can be devastating.
Right. Well, and you talk about like risperidone. One of the issues with that I see in so many people is just enormous weight gain, so rapid, so unbelievable. Yeah, and they're giving those medications to kids with autism, and I would think twice before I gave it to my kid. And it's not that it doesn't work in terms of, you know, controlling the symptoms, and it depends on what you're dealing with, what issues. You know, if your kid is repetitively headbanging and, you know, it's serious danger of hurting themselves and the medication helps, well.
Well, I think Zyprexa was one that had enormous weight gain.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes, certainly in people that are susceptible to maturity onset diabetic, being a maturity onset diabetic at 20 or 30 versus 60.
Yes.
Since you usually have 25 years, unless you are very religious about your glucose levels.
Yes, which people who are psychotic are probably unlikely to be.
Usually their hemoglobin A1C is not real great sometimes, and I think this is a real concern when you look at the medications. And this dream team that I mentioned, I think their approach is trying to get more basic knowledge, kind of using the human genome approach as well as basic research to be able to get better diagnostics and combination therapies, hopefully.
Yeah.
Question.
Well, I'm not in the field, but I'm just wondering. So this is maybe your opinion, and I'm just wondering if other mental health professionals agree that observable symptoms is the best way to make a diagnosis irrespective of the cause.
Yeah, I think the reality is this: the DSM, that book, is how we are taught to diagnose. And that book is based on, you know, observable symptoms. It's not that people don't think about cause. It's just that nobody can agree on cause. And, you know, we think about it, but the diagnosis, for most of us, that's how it has to be done. We talk in that language of those diagnoses that are defined by the DSM. I don't think anybody particularly believes that that's the best way. I think a lot of people just don't think about it very much.
We'd like to remind our radio and online audiences that you're listening to Kent Grelling's talk at the Commonwealth Club of California, and we have enough time for one or two more questions. I have a question. You mentioned earlier about Russia. that they look at something different. Is there any cross-cultural studies going on about how mental health ideas are defined or not defined? And somebody sort of looking into this as a way of moving it down, moving the number down or moving it up? Or
yeah, I don't know if there's a whole field of cross-cultural psych that looks at that issue and about how mental health, and obviously there's, you know, hundreds of cultures in the world who have no concept of a mental health diagnosis, right? They don't see that as relevant. They, you know, that's a very medicalized and Western way of looking at things. But there are absolutely, you know, now even in cultures that sort of speak in the same general language, you know, the Chinese are diagnosing things in children that we don't diagnose, video game addiction being one of them, and they're diagnosing it like crazy. I think there's concerns that they have the same issues going on there, that money and other things, people set up treatment programs and they spread the diagnosis out, and then those kids get brought into them, and so there's a strong incentive to spread that out. And it's not my area of expertise, but there's no question that we have very different views. And the rest of the world, the DSM is the U.S. The rest of the world uses the ICD-10 or ICD-9 thing, but it basically, it's very similar, very parallel kind of categories for mental health.
So is the video game industry behind that diagnosis in China?
No, I think they're probably campaigning to get it outlawed. Oh, yeah, I don't know.
All right. Any last final questions? Anyone with the last question? All right. Thank you very, very much, Ken, for that great presentation.
Thanks for coming.
I'd like to thank our audience here at the club, as well as those listening on the radio and online. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, held during its 107th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.